Dear friends and colleagues, I speak to you again today from the presidency of CISA and trust that you and yours are well as we try and cope with the exigencies of the COVID-19 pandemic and the extended lockdown recently announced. Today, I do want to share some thoughts with you on how it is that psychology as a science, practice, discipline, and profession can extend its services and thereby its social and public value footprint in these uncertain times to cater much more widely for psychosocial well-being and broader social wellness. Firstly, though, I do want to extend my thanks to all of you as CISA members, individuals, and those from other organizational formations for the exemplary commitment to bringing resources into the public domain, for coordinating support for frontline health workers and security personnel, for ensuring equitable psychological services by engaging medical aides, and for your public intellectual engagement on the new frontiers of psychology's contributions to understanding and intervening in the COVID-19 crisis. I wish to extend a special thanks to the CISA office staff for coordinating so many of these activities, as well as the leadership of the organization, from council to the executive, to our divisions and standing committees, and of course, to the rest of the presidency. To return to the matter of wider psychosocial well-being and broader social wellness, I am, of course, referring to the importance of constantly knitting together our more traditional psychological understandings and the interventions with the social contexts and needs that are inextricably linked to them, as well as the importance of deploying psychological skills in the service of overall social cohesion and integration, especially in these times of upheaval. And to this end, I would like to briefly speak to 5 key points. Firstly, I would like to speak to the move towards virtual psychological service delivery. While this is a creative and very, very necessary shift that should be commended, it has also been a site of hotly contested debate in the past. Rather than simply seamlessly moving to this format for the expediency of service delivery, now is the time to have the debates more robustly than ever about the medium, its pros and its cons. It is apparent that practitioners will not only have to deal with the mental health challenges of their traditional base of service users, but will now also have to address the attendant demands of virtual and remote living, the realistic fears of people that are actually not based in their neuroses, that we will have to reconfigure relationality and emotional connection in this medium, and that we will have to be mindful that we are now also contributing to the digitization and digitalization of social and psychological life, and to the gigabyte economy in which the working day is potentially infinite and where all aspects of our lives bleed into each other. Moving to a virtual format is not simply about the minor technical matters of offering psychotherapy, but is raising key health and social questions for us all. We, of course, also need to be mindful that virtual therapies are the domain of the privileged predominantly, and that we run the risk of deepening the psychological access divide in this moment. To this end, we will have to be thinking about additional and alternative modes of care and mediums of delivery for those less privileged and who find themselves on the other side of the digital divide. This brings me to my second point, and this speaks to additional and alternative modes and mediums of care for communities more broadly. Beyond our traditional psychotherapeutic practice, we should be aware of the importance of our skill sets and the expert positions that are conferred upon us, and should be considering how to exercise these for the benefit of communities as community psychologists, irrespective of whether we consider ourselves to be community psychologists or not, to provide health, mental health, and psychosocial information, to train first responders and other healthcare workers, to promote community organization and localized actions, and to encourage community surveillance systems that counteract levels of violence, stigmatization, and mitigate the resurgence of scapegoating minorities. These can all be done through mediums such as radio, television, the print media, and basically accessible social media platforms to which the majority of South Africans have access. I want to encourage you all to take this challenge up seriously, even if it takes you out of your comfort zones. Third, there's a growing narrative in the public domain about the contagion threat and its catastrophic unfolding if it spreads through community transmission within the many overcrowded and poorer communities in South Africa. This is a concern for all of us, but what is unhelpful is a narrative that increasingly suggests that the most vulnerable will eventually become the most risky. History is filled with such exemplars, from the plagues in antiquity to TB, HIV/AIDS and Ebola, and how they have become the proxy measures to define the most marginal and black in Africa in particular as the social receptacle of this contamination. As psychologists, we need to offer alternative readings of these unfolding social repertoires and be part of shaping the narrative that avoids blame and stigmatization and the politics of catastrophe that is connected to those who are relegated to lives on the fringes of our society. We must offer alternative understandings of why non-compliance, for example, to lockdown regulation occurs, especially in communities where lives are already at risk every day and the sense of a foreshortened future is ever present. Compliance will only be attained if everyone believes that they have a life that is worth saving and one that is worth living. And we should be at the forefront of shaping this narrative and actions in support of every life being worthy. Fourth, as trite as this may sound, we should all be throwing our collective weight behind various advocacy agendas that speak to how the broader social and structural environment is deeply implicated in psychosocial health and social wellness. I ask that you all reflect on what will be needed at the policy and intervention levels to sustain such health and wellness. It will require bold economic stimulus interventions, support for continued work and employment, interventions to counter environmental degradation that of course contribute to contagion spread, support for education of our children and youth in this moment, ramped up health services, social welfare interventions for the indigent, accommodation for the countless homeless, and food banks and food security drives to ensure basic nutrition for the aged, the frail, and the poor. Advocacy is a key strategy that requires all of our support in this moment. Fifth and finally, I want to speak to all of you directly, and I want to encourage an animated recalibration of our assessment of what we can offer as psychologists and how we can shift our identities and social roles. Pandemics always usher in a time of potential change, and we should not allow this crisis to pass by without profound consideration of what we want our discipline, profession, practice, and science to be in relation to humanity. While many of us see ourselves as providing deep care for others, we have so much more to offer than our emotional labor, and we should aspire to this potential and the pinnacle of serving humanity in this time. I wish you and your dearest relations health and safety in this time, and know that we as SAISA are here to support you through all of our structures in the days, weeks, and months to come. Thank you, be well, and be safe.